Andre puts in a few hard steps, comes right next to him, looks over at him. Usain looks back at over at him. They start smiling at each other. And Andre says, I'm not letting you take this so easily, and just keeps on pressing and pressing and pressing. And it turns out, you know, that was to that day and up until last year, that was Andre's PR in the 200. That was 1980, and Usain ran 1978. And the strategy worked. Usain started cramping. He was actually taken back to the warm-up track on a wheelchair.
Stu McMillan, that's the intro. Everyone should know who he is. Just kidding. So 26 years of coaching, co-founder, CEO of Altus, and also short sprints coach. He's coached over 70 Olympians across 9 Olympic Games, accruing over 30 Olympic medals. Anyone who's in our space, which I feel like it's a relatively small space, should know who he is. He and Altus is one of the biggest influences of myself and also TC Boost as a whole. It's like Altus, Chris Corfus, Troy Francis, Derek Hansen, all those guys. So I always drop your name and Altus's name when talking about myself and interviews, whatever it may be. So you've been a huge impact on not only where I work, but also myself. You've been super nice playing some phone tag, going back and forth, as well as speaking with us last year. I always love consuming the content you make, whether it's written, whether it's spoken, and I'm super excited to have you on today. So first, did I miss anything? Second, thanks for joining. And third, let's get into it.
Yeah, I appreciate the intro, man. You nailed it. It was good. Most of the intros that hosts give these days are kind of, they're relying on bios that are multiple years old, so they're a little bit off, but you nailed it, man. That's good. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. You're welcome. So short, sweet, kind of new podcast style, as this will be episode 127, I think. Don't quote me, somewhere around there. Just Stu's craziest story from 26 years of coaching. So we have two lined up. We chatted a little bit beforehand, but let's get into the first one.
Yeah, well, the first one is a bit of a fun one, right? So there's no lesson to be learned from this story. It's a story from 2016, and it's the story behind one of the most famous pictures in track and field. So everyone's seen the picture and the video of Usain Bolt and Andre Degrasse sort of smiling at each other down the stretch of the 200 meters. It was actually the 200 meters semifinal. So I'll just tell a story behind that. So as you might know or might not know, I coached Andre at those games and coached him starting in 2015 and up until 2018. And the 200 was the second event. So we'd already ran the 100. Andre had medaled in the 100 meters. Usain had obviously won the 100 meters. We've basically been racing every single day. Andre was pretty tired, but Andre's 21 years old at the time, and Usain is, I think, 32. Usain is faster than Andre in 2016. There's no question about that. There's if both of them are running at their best at the Olympic Games, on the day Usain's going to win the race. It's just the reality of where we were at the time. So, but we also knew that Usain had been injured quite a lot that year. I'd heard him complaining about the heat and the humidity. And I know the way that he wants to run this 200, this semifinal, is to put in as little effort as possible, keep all of his energy for the final, and then just blast the final. So our goal or our strategy, what I told Andre to do here in the semi was, okay, don't let him win this. Don't let him walk this. Don't let him come off the bend and just jog the last 80 meters, and you jog beside him. You both run 20.3, both get into the final, because he's going to beat you in the final. The only way for you to beat him in the final is if he's tired. So the goal was, let's make him work. And ideally, he starts cramping up, because I'd heard him complaining about it starting to cramp a little bit. Ideally, he's cramping up, and then he's toast for the final. So we knew that Usain generally likes to hit the bend pretty hard, come off in control of the race, have a look around, and just jog in. So I said, let him take the bend, come off the bend, accelerate up to him, and don't let him win. run beside him, but don't let him take this too easily. So that was what it was. So you can see Andre coming off the bend. He's saying he's 2 or 3 meters ahead of him. Andre puts in a few hard steps, comes right next to him, looks over at him. Usain looks back at over at him. They start smiling at each other. And Andre says, I'm not letting you take this so easily, and just keeps on pressing and pressing and pressing. And it turns out, you know, that was to that day and up until last year, that was Andre's PR in the 200. That was 1980, and Usain ran 1978. And the strategy worked. Usain started cramping. He was actually taken back to the warm-up track on a wheelchair, getting everyone running around trying to get ice. And, you know, so I got a big smile on my face, right? I'm watching Andre come, just walk back to the warm-up track. You know, he's walking, he's feeling great. You know, we're just smiling at each other. Oh, man, that worked perfectly. Now, the final is the following day. And yet, sure enough, excuse me, Usain was tired. Like really tired. You can tell warming up that he was tired, but Andre was also really tired, you know? So as he'd been racing now 4 days in a row or 5 days in a row, whatever it was, they both put as much as they could into the final as he possibly could. Usain, obviously we know now, Usain won it. Andre came second. Probably what would have happened regardless of what we did in the semifinal, but it gave us a shot. And, you know, neither one of those guys ran as fast in the final as he did in the semifinal. So it did work from that perspective. But, you know, Andre didn't quite have enough on the day to beat him. So that was the story behind that smile, that famous picture, that famous video in Rio.
Fantastic. So when you get up to that level and all those, and you see those guys at like every meet, are they like buddies? Is that why they smiled, or would he have smiled at anyone who was next to him?
No, they weren't buddies at all. I mean, I don't think they'd had much more than 2 or 3 conversations of 2 or 3 sentences, you know.
So he was more just surprised.
Yeah, it was just, hey, what are you doing? I mean, and then, you could see Usain started wagging his finger at him. Hey, what are you doing, man? Just ease off. We're supposed to be just jogging in here. We're qualifying for the final. I don't need you pressing me here. So that's why he started wagging his finger. Usain was pissed. Like, he was legitimately not happy with Andre over that. It was funny.
Last follow-up question, because although I'm a speed coach, I don't coach actual track and field. I feel like navigating the qualies, prelims, semis leading up to that, as you just shared, that how much effort you expend in the semis can influence your run in the finals. So where's that fine line between, like, you're conserving energy but you don't want to miss the actual making it to the next race? So in general, kind of how do you coach, or how do you describe that to someone who's not in track and field, kind of that walking that fine line, working your way up to the finals?
Yeah, it's a good question, right? We actually saw that happen a few times in the Tokyo Games where some of the athletes messed up on that. Sharika Jackson, was one of the favorites to medal in the 200 and took her heat far too easily and didn't make it through the rounds. You know, so the easy way to do it is you run the first 100, if it's a 200, you run the first 100 of the 200 exactly the way you would if it's a final. And then you look around, you see where you're at, and you put in just enough effort to get into the position that you need to be in. And if it's 100, it's the same thing. You run the 60 or the 70 or the 80, depending on who's in that heat with you, exactly the same way. And then you just sort of check where you are. Andre was great at this. You know, he would run 80 as if it was a final, have a look around, you know, just check his shoulders. If you can ease up, ease up. If you can't ease up, don't. Because the goal, you know, in championship racing, it's so reliant upon the lane that you're in. Even in 100, you know, it's really hard to win medals at a lane 1 or lane 8. You got to be in the middle of the race. And it's especially hard in the 200. If you're in lane 1 or lane 8, it's almost impossible. It doesn't happen. So you're really trying to set up, okay, what do I need to do to be in lanes 3, 4, 5, or 6 in the final? And then work backwards from there, you know, and then you write your strategies around, okay, who's in the race with me? What are they going to be doing? How are they racing their race? And then you just sort of, okay, well, work back from there and figure it out. But you're right, it's really important. But the important bit is, from a strategic standpoint, is you run the first half or first 60% of the race exactly as you always do. And then you just check the position of everybody else. But if you go in understanding where most of the other athletes will be, that's really helpful. A lot of people don't do that.
So that last 20, 30 meters easing up makes a big, big difference in the long run, or saving your energy in those last 20, 30?
It can. I mean, that's somewhat debatable.
Or is it more psychological?
It's potentially psychological. I think it can definitely make a difference in running twos and fours. I'm not sure how much of a difference it makes in 100, because you're at 70, 80 meters. You're at max velocity already. Mm. You've done the work to get there. So, easing down to, run the last couple segments, a couple tenths slower. I don't know how much difference that makes, to be honest with you, but it's, everyone likes to do it. And, better safe than sorry, I guess.
Yeah,
you don't want to have to work super hard through it. So if you can ease down a little, it's not going to be detrimental, is it?
In the 200
for sure. So
yeah, makes sense. Sure, yeah. Cool. So last craziest story with a little bit more real world value, as you shared earlier, I'm excited to hear it. So let's do it.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if it's a crazy story. It's a story which really taught me a lesson and really affected, it probably even affected the medalists in the Rio Olympics in 200 meters. So I coached a U.S. sprinter named Amir Webb. And Amir, going into the 15-16 season, was okay. He was a pretty good American sprinter. He had PRs of 10.02 in the 100 and 20.04 in the 200. But he'd been training up until the point. So we're talking now sort of late March, early April. Training had been going fantastic. He's in part of a great group. He's surrounded by a bunch of guys around 9 seconds. And we opened up at a meet in Arizona. And sorry, I have to back up a little bit just to give you a little bit of context here. He opened up and he ran 10.02 in his first race. So he PR'd in his first race. And then the next week we went to Los Angeles and ran the Mount Stack meet. And he ran 990 windy with 2.4, I think, and won that race. It was a pretty hot race, including Andre. Andre was in that race. I think he came second. And then ran the 200 and ran 1991 in the 200 legal, which at the time was the world lead and big PR for him. And that got him into basically any Diamond League race that he wanted to get into based on these two times. He now ran sub 10, albeit a little bit windy, but a legal 19.9 200. Went to 2 weeks later, went to Doha, ran 19.84, which remains his PR to this day, actually. Won that race, was basically dominating the Diamond League circuit. Every race that he went into, he won. A few weeks after that, we went to Rome for the Rome Diamond League. And while we're warming up for the 200, he's there to run the 200. And I'm there with, I think I'm actually there only with him. I don't think we've got anybody else there. So it's just me and him. We're warming up for the 200. And I think it was his agent that actually came up to me in the warm-up and said, hey, there, somebody dropped out of the 100 and there's a lane available in the 100. Do you want to run the 100 as well? And the 100 starts 45 minutes after the 200. So I'm thinking, that's pretty tight. 200, then 45 minutes later, it's running 100. But I went over to Amir and said, hey, do you want to run 100? It's after the 200. The 200 is a money event for him anyway. He's not going to win the 100. So he says, yeah, man, I'll run it. Said, okay, cool, let's do it. So before he goes out onto the track, we knew that he's going to win the 200. That wasn't a problem. So I talked to Amir, said, you've got 45 minutes. After this 200, make sure you get back here quick. And, let's get you ready for the 100. We've got basically 20 to 30 minutes, but before we got to get you back in the call room to go back out and run this 100. We just, our biggest thing here is we can't get you hurt running the 100. So sure enough, he goes out there, runs the 200, dominates the 200, but runs it absolutely perfectly. It's a really good field, but we knew he was going to win that. And he got excited. Rome's, there's 40 or 50,000 people watching the meet. He gets thrown the flowers, it's all on TV. Everybody's screaming. Excuse me. He starts doing the lap of honor. So he starts jogging around the track, doing a lap of honor, waving to everybody. And, I just won the 200, right? That's what you do. totally forgets about the 100 and totally forgets that as you're doing the lap of honor, there's a reason why most of the sprinters, while they do this lap of honor, take their spikes off. You ever tried jogging with your spikes on? It's not a good idea. He does the entire lap in his spikes, waving to everybody, gets back to the warm-up track like half an hour later. By this time, we've got 15 minutes before he's got to get back into the call room and get ready for the 100. And he says, "Coach, my calves are cramping like crazy. They're killing me." Because he just jogged 400 meters in his spikes. So, of course they are. So we get him on the table, and I'm working like crazy. You know, I'm sweat dripping off me. I'm just working on his calves for 15 minutes. Just to see, just, all right, we're probably not going to be able to do the 100 here, but, you know, we'll do it. We'll see what we can get done. So I take the tension out of his calves. I said, "Just do an easy stride." He does an easy stride on the grass. He says, "Yeah, they feel okay." All right, off you go. So basically, he's done nothing now for 45 minutes other than me working on his calves for 15 minutes. One easy stride, goes and sits in the call room. Goes out in the 100, doesn't do a warm-up start, just sets up his blocks and just waits. Because he doesn't want the calves to cramp, right? So he's just in a headspace here. My only shot here is just to do one run, and that's it. The race, you know, the gun goes for the race. His calf kind of cramps on his second step. He almost falls. Doesn't quite fall. Adrenaline just kicks in. He's able to accelerate out of this stumble, runs everybody down, and comes second by a thousandth to Justin.
What?
Gatlin runs 9.938, and Amir ran 9.941 or something. Like, it was 3,000ths behind Gatlin. Ran down the entire field, like a really strong field. Still his PR to this day, 9.99. Oh my. You know, kicked 700ths off of his PR or 800ths off of his PR, whatever it was. So now we've got a decision. He's just gone, you know, won the 200, 45 minutes later. He's come second in this 100. He's feeling great. We're confident. And we've got three more competitions to run before we head back to the U.S. And this is Olympic season, right? So we know we're heading back to the U.S. to get ready for trials. And trials at this point in time, I think, is a month away. Yeah, I think it's a month. And my brain immediately went to conversations I had with Dan Path, who said, essentially, that anytime one of his athletes PR'd in Europe, he brought them back. Because this is, you know, your body's never done this. Your system has never gone to this speed before. It's better. You're better safe than sorry. Let's just come back, reset. Let's just not, you know, there's more downside to staying over and racing than there is just to come back and just make sure that you're recovering well from this new load that you've imparted upon your system. So this is going through my brain. But I also understand, all right, Amir is, like, he's almost a lock at this point to medal in Rio in the 200. I'm thinking it's between Usain, Andre, and Rio, and Amir. There's really nobody else that's going to medal. Amir's beaten everybody. But there's a few people that he hadn't raced yet. And he was going to see all of those guys in the next three races that we set up for Europe. So the next race was going to be Birmingham, which was a 200, and then it was Oslo, which was 100, and then Lucerne in Switzerland, which was another 200. And over the course of those three races, he'd see everybody except for Bolt. So Bolt would be the only guy that he wouldn't have raced before going into Rio. And I thought it was important that he'd seen everybody, so it wasn't going to be new when he got to the games. So we had a conversation about it. I said, these are our options. We can pull out of these next three races and head back. Or you'd be heading back because I have to stay over because I've got, you know, Andre's coming over and a few other guys are coming over. But you can head back to Phoenix, start working with the assistant coaches over there, and I'll see you back there in 2 weeks. Or we can stay over and get this work done against these other guys. So we decided, all right, let's stay over. So we go to Birmingham next. We meet Andre in Birmingham. Andre ends up winning that race in the rain, in the cold. He runs 2016 into like a negative 1.8. And Amir comes fifth, running 20:50 something. So that wasn't very good. But this is like 4 days after Rome. So I know that he's still super tired from Rome. And that was kind of the risk, right? We knew that, all right, you're not going to recover great from this, but we'll see where we're at.
Were you like holding your breath the whole time?
Well, I didn't think he was going to get hurt, but I just didn't want it to be real bad.
All right.
You know, and it was bad. Like, it wasn't good. You don't go from running, you know, 19.8s, 19.9s, and 20 flats to running 20.50 something, even if it is into a headwind. Then coming fifth. And then we go to Oslo, and he's running 100 in Oslo. Not as much pressure, but the last 100, he ran 9.94. And it's a pretty nice night. It's cold, but he runs 10.18, and he comes fifth or fourth. It wasn't good. And then we've got Lucerne 3 days later. We're pot committed now. I mean, we're in, right? So it's like we're gonna play this out, even though it's probably after any of these races, I should have said, no, we're done. Let's just head on home. We go to Lucerne, and he runs 20.84 in Lucerne in the cold and the rain, and comes like, again, fifth or fourth or something. It was really bad. By this time, he's miserable. He's missing home. This is his first European trip of anything more than kind of a few days. We're over there now for 2 weeks. And it started off as this Rome, this zenith, right? This best day in his life, in his sprinting career, where he finally got under 10 seconds. And he just got worse and worse and worse. And I could see how miserable he was. I said, man, Amir, we made the wrong decision here. You're toast, mentally you're toast, physically you're toast. Just head back to California, because I know, you know, how much he really enjoys going back home to California. So just head back to California for 10 days. Let's just take 10 days where you just do warm-ups by yourself. Just reboot. So he goes back to California and totally just, you know, enjoys 10 days of non-track stuff, understanding that in 10 days he comes back to Phoenix and we've got essentially about 10 days or 12 days to get ready for the Olympic trials. Well, he comes back to Phoenix and he's like 6 pounds heavy. He'd gone back to California and really enjoyed
being back in California.
So he's kind of chubby. He hasn't got a lot of training done. We've got 10 days to get him ready for, you know, for trials. And we're still, like, he's still fatigued. He's still fatigued from he's still fatigued from Rome, which is now 3 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
You know, prior to this, it's, you know, the load, you know, the lesson from this is we just don't understand the types of load that these elite athletes put through their system at that type of level. We can't understand that. We can't even begin to think about whether we can understand that. We just can't, you know, like, this affected him for a month afterwards.
Wow.
And it wasn't just the Rome thing. It was everything else, right? It was all of the, I'm miserable now. I'm over in Europe and it's cold everywhere I'm going. I'm not getting, you know, the food that I'm used to. I'm racing poorly. So it's this downward spiral. It gets worse and worse and worse. So where if we'd left Europe after Rome and headed back, he's super confident. He's back where he wants to be. He's in the warmth and he's just getting ready for trials. He probably goes into trials thinking he's unbeatable and probably goes in and runs 19.6. Then he probably goes to the games and runs 19.6 again and maybe wins. Instead, he's going into trials and he doesn't know where he's at. We can't do anything in Phoenix because now he's 5 or 6 pounds heavy. He hasn't really ran fast for a while. So we're not really going to open him up 10 days prior to trial. So all we can basically do is, all right, let's just get you back to feeling good. So we did some work to hopefully get him feeling good again. He went into trials with no understanding how he's going to feel. Ran pretty good in the round, ran 19.97, I think, in the semi. So now he's okay. I'm back. I'm okay. I'm confident. I can make the team at least. Ran 20 flat in the final to come third. Now what happened though in the final was really disappointing. He was in lane 6, I believe. And it was Michael Norman, who was a high school kid at the time, was in lane 8. It was either Norman or Lyles. And I can't remember. I think it was Norman that was outside of him. And in the corner of his eye, at about 180, 190, he sees Norman and he thinks Norman's coming. He's not, but he sees him. So he panics a little bit. He starts overstriding and he dips at the line, even though he doesn't have to dip. I mean, he's a tenth ahead of the guy. But he pulls his hamstring. He tears his hamstring at the line.
Tears.
Yeah, so he's got like, you know, a pretty serious grade 1 tear, almost grade 2. And then he's got to do, you know, he's got to do all this press and stuff. So he's on his feet for like an hour.
Oh, man.
Can't even get ice on it after this. So now we're rehabbing him. and we've got a month to get him ready for
a month,
you know, off of a, you know, grade one, almost grade two. So he goes to Rio, he runs, he made the semi, ran 20:30 and didn't make the final. That was it. And it was, all of this was, you know, the lesson there is, well, there's, I mean, there's a couple lessons. One, we don't understand the load. Number two is, if you've got a heuristic, which is, you know, okay, somebody PRs on the road, get them off the road and go and reboot from that, you know, live by it. If that's a heuristic that you're living by, and let's just stick to it. Don't talk yourself out of it from by for some other reason, you know. Another one, don't, you know, I guess 2 weeks or 3 weeks away from trials, don't send an athlete home by himself for 10 days, even if you think that is a good idea at the time. That's probably not a good idea. Yeah, so that was a really harsh lesson for me that probably ended up costing an athlete an Olympic medal. You know, there's no doubt in my mind he would have been right there with Andre. You know, he'd either beaten Andre or been right there just behind Andre in the 200. You know, whether he'd won come second or come third, there was a medal there for him, and he didn't get it because of, you know, some bad coaching decisions on my part. So it was it's a real big lesson for me. Hopefully we'll heed and learn from.
Oh my gosh, what a crazy story. That is super interesting. Thank you for sharing. I have a few follow-up questions. So I guess I'll kind of go chronologically based on the story. So how easy, being like a track outsider, assuming most people aren't at the super elite track level like yourself, how easy is it when you're like, yeah, we'll just like do the 100, to then consequently be like, yeah, we'll like back out? Like, how easy would that be to have reversed that decision?
Yeah, easy. It's not hard. I mean, yeah, you don't want to do it a lot. You know, it's if you're not the headliner at a meet, they can replace you pretty quickly and pretty easily at most of these competitions. If you're a headliner, you don't want to do it.
Gotcha.
Right? Because they're kind of, you know, marketing the meet around you as the headliner. Amir was never the headliner, so he's just one of the lanes. I mean, yeah, he's one of the best lanes. But, you know, if we need to pull out, you know, that happens all the time. You know, agents, coaches, and athletes will confirm for a competition, you know, generally weeks, sometimes months in advance. And the meet directors will know that, you know, probably up to 25% of the athletes will pull out at some point. So they've always got people in reserve to step into lanes if necessary. So it wouldn't have been an issue. I mean, we might have pissed off a couple of people, but it wouldn't have been a problem. You know, those are decisions though that you make based upon a lot of things, right? It's, you know, money is one of them. You know, we try not to allow money to be a decision maker in Olympic season. In an Olympic season, it's all about the Olympics and that's it. We don't chase money. But these athletes generally don't make a lot of it. And in competitions like this, when you can go and make $10,000 per race, you know, that's significant for these guys who might only make $100,000 a year or less. You know, so it's that I don't remember that being something that we governed our decision by back then. I thought we, you know, like I said, it's the decision was made based on the fact that we feel we have to race these guys, and we're feeling great, and we know that we're gonna go out and beat those guys. That was it. And in hindsight, as I said, it's all right. Let's just get home. You know, we'll disappoint a few people. Maybe the agent's gonna be a little bit upset. Maybe the meet directors will be a little bit upset, but it won't be the end of the world.
And then next might be a noob question, but I'm gonna play the I'm representing the audience card. How different? So like going to see those guys race that he's never raced against before. Is it, how impactful is that running next to them against in a race versus like just like watching them race from the stands? Would it really have made a big difference to have raced against those guys versus watch them race versus not be there at all?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, for some athletes, it won't make any difference at all. I would say that for most, it does. You want to be able to feel what these athletes do, number one. You want to, you know their tendencies. All right, I know what this guy does. And if I never raced this guy before and I'm going into a race with him in the Olympic Games, then it's a bit of an unknown there, right? You want to be comfortable. Even if you get beat by the guy, at least you know what it is. But and second to that is the confidence part. Like, we, you know, at the point we made that decision, we didn't think that Amir would get beat by anybody other than his training partner, other than Andre. So it was, okay, we know that we can go out and just roll up everybody. And then when you show up in Rio, you've beaten everybody. You know that. And also, all of those people that you've beaten know that you've beaten.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's an important thing, you know? It really is going into a games. So it was, we felt like that was an important thing, especially for him and for his personality. For many athletes, it wouldn't have made any difference. Like for Andre, for example, that would have been a totally different decision. He doesn't care, you know, but many athletes do, and it would make a difference.
And a heuristic is something that I've heard you talk about multiple times in the various presentations that I've heard you give online and I think in person or on Zoom as well. And I must say, as I do dabble in some sports gambling, only $5-$10 at a time, but having a system takes a huge emotional part out of it, or whether it's my investing, like dollar cost averaging. Every 2 weeks you put X amount in. It helps limit volatility. It takes the emotion and the guessing out of it. I feel like that's the biggest thing, whether it's sports science and data, a system, a heuristic. There's no question. PR, feeling super good, we're going home. Because have you coached the same amount as Dan, or has he coached a little bit longer?
No, Dan's 10 years older than me. So he's coached for 45 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I started coaching when I was 14, but I started coaching sort of more elite athletes when I was 25 or so. I'm 52 now. So it's,
yeah,
you know, I've been coaching elite people for, you know, almost 30 years, or he's been coaching elite people for over 40.
Wow. And it's not to say that a heuristic makes every decision, but it at least gives a super solid kind of framework, or it helps get you like 75% of the way there. There's a ton of context, and obviously, and that just justifies conversation. That's how I describe sports science. Data discussion decision. Well, you have your heuristic, that's the data. And then you discuss with your athletes and stuff. You use your own intuition, and then you make a decision and go from there. But it makes total sense for sure. So it's a super interesting story. But one thing that sucks about coaching is I have a few myself. Is the ones that don't work out stick out in your mind compared to the ones that really, really do, the ones that you crushed? And I'm sure that over 30 medals, you know, but the one that you chose to speak about is the one that, you know, didn't pan out. So it's definitely, sure.
Yeah. It's funny how the mind works that way, huh?
It is. It sucks, but a super awesome story, a bunch of insight as well. So I want to say thank you very much again for playing some phone tag with me, for giving me some of your time and sharing these super interesting stories. So last, I'm going to roll out the red carpet for you to shamelessly plug, emphasis on shameless, whatever you have to plug. Where can people get more Coach Stu and Altus?
Well, we're on all of the social media platforms at Altus, A-L-T-I-S, or Altus, however you pronounce it. I'm on Twitter at Stuart McMillan 1, and on Instagram at Fingermash. And then just look out for next month. We are releasing our Performance Trinity. Our three big courses are up for sale next month. So look out for that. It's middle of March or late March. So we're sort of gearing towards that right now. So it's, Matt, I appreciate your time, man. I appreciate your question and inviting me on.